Hi, well, can I add my welcome to Trevor's? I'm the curate from All Saints Church. It is good to see you here. Now, it's been quite a controversial book, Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code. It's certainly been a bestseller, one that's caused controversy in many circles. Well, our hope tonight is that we're going to throw a little bit of light on the book from a Christian perspective. We are very fortunate to have with us Dr. Gary Williams, who's a lecturer in church history and theology at Oak Hill Theological College in North London. And without any more ado, I'll pass over to Gary.
As Trevor was giving his notice, I had this image in my mind of the marquee going up in smoke and some poor soul seated somewhere around the third, fourth or fifth row, paralysed, seeking to calculate which row they were in and therefore which door they should leave by. There is no doubt, is there, that the Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown is a hugely successful novel. The facts speak for themselves. It is apparently presently being translated into 40 languages, so it can be read all around the world. I met somebody last night at an event like this who told me that he has lots of friends in India who are presently reading the book and very puzzled by what it says. By the end of 2004, the book had apparently earned Dan Brown £140 million. And of course, he's had a few more months at the top of the bestseller chart, and Angels and Demons is up there, probably at number two, and Digital Fortress is probably somewhere in the top ten as well, so he's doing rather well out of it. Most of the reviews of the book, you may have read some of the ones inside the front cover, have been gushingly positive. The New York Times said, "The word is wow." And Salon.com, in what I take it is meant to be a positive verdict, called it the pulp must read of the season. So I have to admit, if somebody called a book that I wrote the pulp must read, I might think it was a veiled insult. It's clear, isn't it, why people like the book. It's a page turner, it's a gripping read, it's a classic read on the beach or by the pool, keep turning the pages, you started at 9 o'clock, you're still there at 1 o'clock in the morning. It's one of those. But also there's more to it than that, and this perhaps accounts for its extraordinary success. It contains intriguing ideas about religion and history and Jesus Christ. Readers may feel that by reading the book, they've been initiated into an ancient secret which has not formally been disclosed, but which they now share with Dan Brown and the others who know the secrets of the Priory of Zion. Others, however, have been a little less positive about the novel. There have been indeed some extremely critical reactions. Let me give you one example from a weekend newspaper. We read this in the review. Brown's book is not garbage. It is garbage on stilts. Hyper-garbage that invokes garbage in self-authentication. Carl Olson and Sandra Measel write this in their book about the Da Vinci Code. The Da Vinci Code is custom-made fiction for our time. Pretentious, posturing, self-serving, arrogant, self-congratulatory, condescending, glib, illogical, superficial, and deviant. You get the slight impression that they didn't enjoy it. So why is it that it provokes such extreme reactions? Why is it that some people really don't like it? The key here is that people object to the way that the book attempts to rewrite the history of Jesus Christ, to tell an alternative story about Jesus Christ from that which we find in the Bible. And it's this rewriting of history in the book which will be the focus of our attention this evening. At the outset, though, perhaps I need to deal with a thought that may arise in your minds, though probably given that you're here, it hasn't arisen, but I'll deal with it anyway. You may be thinking, don't take it so seriously. Don't get so wound up about it. It's just a novel. It's fiction. Why take it so seriously and treat it as if it were a history book, of all things? So let me just begin by giving you four reasons why I think it's worth taking the book seriously. First of all, it's clear that this is how lots of readers are taking the book, and you may be one of them. You meet intelligent, educated, literate people who have been persuaded by the book's claims about Jesus Christ and think that what it says about him being married and having children is true. Let me give you some examples from the BBC website. I've removed the comments from the people from Linfield. Rob from Stafford says, "The claims in the Da Vinci Code are just as plausible as the claims in the Bible." Stephen from Sheffield, "If so many people believe it to be true, then how can it be fiction?" Now, they're not exactly profound comments. If you think about that last one in particular, it's a rather troubling argument, isn't it? Because we could find lots of people who believe lots of contradictory things which can't all be true at once. But that does show us how people are taking the novel. It's also, secondly, how many reviewers are taking the novel as well. It's greeted by many of those reviews inside the front cover as an intelligent, learned book. The New York Daily News says his research is impeccable. The Chicago Tribune calls it brain candy of the highest quality, which is a great story despite transmitting several doctorates worth of fascinating history and learned speculation. Thirdly, this is how Dan Brown himself treats the novel, and that isn't quite clear from the book itself, though there is that fact page at the beginning of it, but it comes out in interviews. On the Today Show, for example, he was asked, "How much of this is based on reality in terms of things that actually occurred? I know you did a lot of research for the book." And he replied, "Absolutely all of it. Obviously, there are, Robert Langdon is fictional, but all of the art, architecture, secret rituals, secret societies, all of that is historical fact." Let's get more specific. What about the claim that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married? He says this, "I was skeptical, but after a year and a half of research, I became a believer." He said this on Good Morning America in November 2003. "I really thought I would disprove a lot of this theory about Mary Magdalene and the Holy Blood and all of that. I became a believer." Now, it is, of course, possible that Dan Brown is just trying to push up sales by making bold claims about the book. But even if that's true, he is nonetheless encouraging people to take the book seriously as a piece of historical research and argument. And then fourthly, there are the books behind the book. Because as you may have noticed from what some of the characters say when they refer to different books as they go, his picture of history is in fact entirely based on other books. Books published over the last 25 years or so, especially a book called Holy Blood, Holy Grail, which was published in the early 1980s. Now, these books on which Brown bases his view of history are not novels. They claim to be exposés of the truth about Jesus Christ and Mary Magdalene. They are asserting that they have discovered the truth. So for those four reasons, I am going to take this book seriously as an historical argument this evening, and I'm going to scrutinize it as a historical picture of what happened with Jesus. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't like machine gun arguments. I think they're slightly cheap, just firing off lots of shots at different targets. But I'm going to do it anyway as we begin. So let me give you, as an initial warning sign, some serious errors of fact that occur throughout the book. Simple, easily identified, serious errors, which may give us reason to hesitate, may give us reason to think that perhaps Dan Brown doesn't know his history so well and is in fact culling most of this stuff from other books. Let me rattle through some examples. Brown says that the Dead Sea Scrolls, together with the Nag Hammadi texts, are, I quote, "the earliest Christian records." But the Dead Sea Scrolls never mention Jesus Christ and have no Christian content to them at all, anywhere. They're simply not Christian records. Brown says that the divinity of Jesus was agreed on at the Council of Nicaea in 325 by a close vote. But only two out of the 250 or so bishops present voted against the decisions of the council, which I don't think anyone would call as a particularly close vote. Brown says that Pope Clement V threw the ashes of burnt Templars into the River Tiber which is in Rome. But Pope Clement V was Pope at Avignon from 1305 to 1314 and never in his life went to Rome. Brown says that Paris was founded by the Merovingians, but long before their time it was a Gallic village called Lutetia Parisiorum, which was in fact made into a city by the Romans. Brown says that the nuns of the Confraternity of the Immaculate Conception gave instructions for the painting of the Madonna of the Rocks. But there are no nuns in the Confraternity of the Immaculate Conception because it's an all-male order. Lastly, Brown says that the documents in the parish national library, which tell of the Priory of Sion, the dossier secret, the secret dossier, have been tested and proved authentic. But they have in fact been exposed as a hoax. Now, this is by far the most serious of these machine gun arguments that I'm giving you here. Some years ago, a French journalist, Jean-Luc Chamoy, exposed these texts as hoaxes, as forgeries. He's published a book on the subject. Even the BBC, back in 1996, put out a documentary about the Priory of Sion, showing that these texts were fraudulent. The forger of the texts, Philippe de Cherisy, has admitted this in a collection of papers, which you can see. Now, given the importance of the Priory of Sion, think about this for the moment. The Priory of Sion begins in 1099, according to Dan Brown. It is the spine through much of the argument of his book. It is the institution which keeps alive the secret of the true identity of the Holy Grail, of the descendants of Jesus, which protects the descendants of Jesus. It's the custodian of Jesus' bloodline. Well, given the prominent role that the Priory of Sion has in the book, this is an enormously serious problem for Brown's picture of history, that the documents, the only documents which attest the existence of the Priory of Sion and its function in history, have been exposed as hoaxes. Now, those are some of the basic mistakes that Brown makes as he goes. And that knocks a bit of a hole in his picture of history from 1099 to the present. But it could still be the case that what he says about the earlier period of time and about Jesus Christ and Mary Magdalene is true. So we're going to go back now, and from a Christian point of view, that's the most interesting argument, isn't it? If Jesus was married and had children, etc., 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 that would be the most significant thing. So we're going to look at the claims that Brown makes about Jesus and early Christianity. And I'm going to give them to you in a series of propositions. Claim one, then, is this. The New Testament was created by Constantine, the Emperor Constantine, who rejected thousands of alternative texts that had been written by the Gnostics, this group of persecuted people. Brown writes, "The fundamental irony of Christianity, the Bible as we know it today, was collated by the pagan Roman Emperor Constantine the Great." That is simply not true. Constantine did ask a bishop, Eusebius, to produce for him 50 copies of the New Testament, which Constantine wanted to use in his new capital, Constantinople. But the work of collating, of gathering together the texts that would make up the New Testament, had been done over the preceding centuries and was already very much in place by then. And there's abundant evidence for this. The most famous piece of evidence is a little text called the Muratorian Fragment. Now, this dates not from the time of Constantine in 300 and something, but from the end of the 2nd century, after 150, before 200. It's named after the Italian scholar who found it, and it is who published it, and it is a list of the books which should be in the New Testament. Four Gospels, Acts, 13 Epistles of Paul, etc., etc. Now, very significantly, the Muratorian Fragment, written way before Constantine was even born, explicitly rejects a whole set of Gnostic texts by Valentinus, one of the Gnostic leaders, and says we must have nothing to do with those texts. Now, that's pretty significant, isn't it? Because long before the evil Constantine came along and started saying nasty things about Gnosticism and trying to exclude Gnostic texts, over 100 years before that, we have a fragment which gives a list of books for the New Testament and which says that the Gnostic texts are to be ruled out of court. But there's also a bit of an irony here, because many scholars of the early church think that the church itself produced its list of New Testament books because the Gnostics had already done it. One of the Gnostics, called Marcion, produced his own version of the New Testament, a pretty edited, butchered kind of New Testament. And lots of historians think that the Christians produced their list to counter his list. Now that gives you quite a different picture from Dan Brown's picture, doesn't it? Because in Brown's picture, the baddies are the Christians trying to exclude the Gnostic texts. But if those historians are right, then the first ones doing the exclusive let's shut it out trick with a list of books were the Gnostics, Marcion, and the Christians then followed suit to counter his list. That would be ironic indeed. Claim number two, getting a bit more specific than the New Testament, Brown claims that the four Gospels were selected by Constantine from among 80 others. He puts it like this: Constantine commissioned and financed a new Bible which omitted those Gospels that spoke of Christ's human traits and embellished those Gospels that made him godlike. The earlier Gospels were outlawed, gathered up, and burned. Or again, he says, more than 80 Gospels were considered for the New Testament, and yet only a relative few were chosen for inclusion. This again is simply wrong about the Gospels. Let me give you one example of why. Many early Christian texts, written again long before Constantine, say that there are and can only be four Gospels accepted by Christians. So that process of selection had taken place way before Constantine's time. Irenaeus, one of the leaders in the early church, who died around the year 200, over a century before Constantine's reign, wrote this, and it's a slightly funny argument. Listen in and see what you think. You don't have to agree with the argument, you just have to note that he's saying there are only four. He writes, "It's not possible that the Gospels can either be more or fewer in number than they are. For since there are four zones of the world in which we live, and four principal winds, while the church is scattered throughout all the world, it's fitting that she should have four pillars. From which fact it's evident that the Word, that is Jesus, who is manifested to men, has given us the Gospel under four aspects, but bound together by one Spirit." It's a slightly curious argument, isn't it? There are four winds, and there are four corners of the earth, therefore there must only be four Gospels. My point isn't to persuade you of the argument, my point is just to show you that here is somebody way before Constantine saying four, no fewer and no more. There were nowhere near 80 Gospels around. When you add up the Gospels that we know there were, you just don't get to 80. There may have been many Gospels. In fact, one of the New Testament writers, Luke, tells us that he's consulted lots of eyewitness accounts of Jesus' life. Christians don't need to deny that there may have been several Gospels, some of which we don't have. But there weren't 80, and there weren't lots of competing Gnostic Gospels that were rejected by Constantine. Claim three. At the Council of Nicaea, Constantine rejected the earthly Jesus and made him divine for the first time. We've already seen a hint of that in a quotation I gave you just now. Again, Constantine says this on the Council of Nicaea, Brown says this on the Council of Nicaea that Constantine gathered. Until that moment in history, Jesus was viewed by his followers as a mortal prophet, a great and powerful man, but a man nonetheless, a mortal. Or again, Constantine turned Jesus into a deity who existed beyond the scope of the human world. So the picture is clear, isn't it? Until then, in 325, no divine Jesus, just a human Jesus. And then bang, Constantine comes up with this idea of the divine Jesus. It is certainly true that the Council of Nicaea did assert that Jesus Christ was fully God. But Brown gets it totally wrong here in two ways. First of all, belief in the full divinity, the full deity of Jesus Christ, had been present from the outset of the Christian faith. It didn't come along in 325. If you look at the letters of Paul, for example, in the New Testament, it shows clearly that he believed that Jesus Christ was fully man, yes, but also fully God. Paul speaks of Jesus as a Jew, as he was, could only speak of God. He takes verses from the Old Testament, language from the Old Testament, that's describing only God, and he applies it unashamedly to Jesus Christ, implying that he is God. For example, the title Lord was a formal title in the Old Testament for God, which Paul uses liberally of Jesus Christ. Again, just after the New Testament time, lots of early Christian literature is clear that Jesus is God. Ignatius of Antioch, who was dead by the year 107, way before anyone even thought of Constantine, wrote this of Jesus: "Very flesh, human, yet spirit too, divine. Uncreated, divine, and yet born human. God and man in one agreed. So the belief in the deity of Jesus went back to the beginning of the Christian faith. Secondly, Brown is wrong when he claims that the four Gospels downplay the humanity and mortality of Jesus, the Gospels that we have in the New Testament. I have to say, and I don't know when you last read a Gospel. Later on, I'm going to try to encourage you to read a Gospel now as a thinking adult. It may be that many of us haven't read Gospels since we were at primary school or something, when you had to do those tedious lessons where you have to rewrite the parables in a modern setting, and the man who rescues the Good Samaritan gets a machine gun or something like that. For many of us, we haven't read the New Testament as thinking adults, and I want to encourage you to that later. But if you have read it recently, you will know that the last thing that the Gospels do is downplay the humanity of Jesus Christ. Think of that reading that you get every Christmas in church. John chapter 1, verse 14. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. A clear affirmation of the humanity of Jesus Christ. And then look at what happens to Jesus in the Gospels. He's born, he grows, he eats, he sleeps, he weeps, he is in agony, and finally, he dies. The Gospels seek to show that Jesus was fully human. Now again, there's a very striking irony here, because Brown wants to tell us that the Gospels deny the humanity of Jesus, whereas the real Gospels, the Gnostic Gospels, they affirm the human Jesus rather than this Constantinian divine figure. But actually, anyone who knows anything about Gnosticism, anyone who's touched on Gnosticism in religious studies, A-level, or anywhere else in their studies, will be able to tell you that the one thing that the Gnostics don't like is the idea that Jesus Christ was fully man. The Gnostics were not wonderfully pro-earthly existence. The Gnostics hated the flesh and anything to do with it. In fact, they propagated a heresy, a corruption of Christian teaching, which was all about denying the true humanity of Jesus and saying that he only appeared to be human and to have flesh, because they thought that the spiritual could not get its hands dirty in the physical and fleshly. This is Constantine, this is the Gnostics. Let me give you an example from a Gnostic text. This is Jesus speaking, and he says this in this Gnostic text, talking about the crucifixion. He whom you saw on the tree, that is on the cross, glad and laughing, this is the living Jesus. But this one into whose hands and feet they drive the nails is his fleshly part, which is the substitute being put to shame, the one who came into being in his likeness. But look at him and me. In other words, the Gnostics thought there were two Jesuses, this pretend physical Jesus on the cross, and then the real Jesus, who is laughing during the crucifixion, untouched by the nails. There's another pretty big irony about Gnosticism and what Dan Brown says about it in claim number four. Claim number four, Gnosticism was all about the sacred feminine. Now, I don't know what attracted you to the book. For many of the women readers of the book, I suspect this is one of the appealing features. Brown appears to be quite feministic, quite pro the idea that women are the spiritual beings and that the sacred feminine has been rejected by society and needs to be rediscovered. And the Gnostics, in his mind, are the great guardians of this heritage of the sacred feminine. But again, I have to tell you, that is an amazing picture of Gnosticism. Nobody who knows anything about Gnosticism could possibly believe that that is right. It is true that Gnosticism does describe some feminine elements, some feminine divine elements. But in actual fact, Gnosticism was overwhelmingly hostile to women. Let me give you an example. In the New Testament, when the Apostle Paul explains the origin of evil in the world, he blames Adam, a man. The Gnostics, when they explain the origin of evil in the world, blame Sophia, a feminine divine power. She was the one who couldn't control her desire and who disrupted spiritual reality with her great longing and desire for the higher powers. She was the one who disrupted the whole cosmos. She was the one. But it gets worse than this. The Gnostics said some pretty shocking things about women. Let me just give you one example of this. From the Gnostic Gospel of Thomas, one of the most famous and popular Gnostic texts, this is how the Gospel ends. speaking of Mary Magdalene. Here's, of course, the great heroine, Dan Brown's novel. The disciples are gathered together with Jesus, and we read this in the last verse, verse 114. Simon Peter said to them, "Let Mary leave us, for women are not worthy of life." Jesus said to them, "I myself shall lead her in order to make her male, so that she too may become a living spirit resembling you males. For every woman who will make herself male will enter the kingdom of heaven." Feminists, indeed. The mention of women, though, brings us closer to the figure at the heart of Dan Brown's novel, Mary Magdalene. But let's step back a bit before we get to her and just look at claim 5, the claim that Jesus had to be married. He had to be married. He writes this. The social decorum during that time virtually forbade a Jewish man to be unmarried. According to Jewish custom, celibacy was condemned, and the obligation for a Jewish father was to find a suitable wife for his son. And again, he argues that a rabbi had to be married in those days. Well, there are a couple of problems here. First of all, Jesus was not in any formal sense a rabbi. He is called a rabbi in the Gospels by his followers as an informal title of respect, but the whole system of having formalized rabbis wasn't in existence at the time of Jesus. It came into existence after the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. That was when rabbinic Judaism took off and became formalized. So at this stage, there were no formal requirements for rabbis, and when the disciples call Jesus a rabbi, they're just calling him teacher as a figure of respect. Secondly, there was also clear precedent for holy men in particular, which is of course what people thought Jesus was, not being married. The Essenes, who are the ones connected to the Dead Sea Scrolls, those famous scrolls about which Brown writes, were noted and esteemed for their celibacy. Two writers, Josephus and Philo, both enthused about the celibacy of the Essenes. So clearly you could be a holy man in Judaism and not be married. Thirdly, the Apostle Paul at one point defended his right, if he wanted to be married. Now, put yourself in his shoes. If you're the Apostle Paul, and you're trying to defend your right to be married, if Jesus had been married, surely that would be your most obvious argument. The Saviour, the Lord himself, was married. But Paul never mentions Jesus being married and appeals to it as an argument for him being allowed to be married. It is therefore not true to say that Jesus had to be married. But what about claim 6? That specifically Mary Magdalene was married to Jesus. Maybe there's more to this detailed claim. Brown makes it very boldly indeed. He writes this on page 330. The marriage of Jesus and Mary Magdalene is part of the historical record. Let me read it again just so you can soak up the force of it. The marriage of Jesus and Mary Magdalene is part of the historical record. A pretty impressive and strong claim. Go back to the book, though, and ask yourself, what evidence does he offer to support this claim? What ancient evidence is there that Jesus was indeed married to Mary Magdalene? And in fact, he cites only one piece of evidence from the Gnostic Gospel of Philip. Here is how he quotes the text on the next slide that's going to come up on the screens. At the top there, you see the way that Brown quotes it. Don't worry if you can't see it, because I'm going to read it out. This is how Brown quotes the text of the Gospel of Philip. "And the companion of the Saviour is Mary Magdalene. Christ loved her more than all the disciples and used to kiss her often on the mouth. The rest of the disciples were offended by it and expressed disapproval. They said of him, 'Why do you love her more than all of us?'" And the character Lee Teabing makes this comment. "As any Aramaic scholar will tell you, the word companion in those days literally meant spouse." That is it. Brown cites no further ancient evidence for Jesus being married. Why not? Because there is none. That is it. That is the only evidence there is. There is no suggestion anywhere else in ancient literature that Jesus Christ was married, let alone married, to Mary Magdalene. But if this evidence is convincing, one piece of evidence might be sufficient. So how good is this evidence for the claim that Jesus Christ was married to Mary Magdalene? First of all, let me tell you when this was written compared to the Gospels that we have in the New Testament. The New Testament Gospels were all written during the first century. We have manuscript fragments which show this. Chances are they were written by AD 70, the destruction of Jerusalem, because they don't describe that explicitly, and it was a monumental event. The Gospel of Philip that we have quoted here was written sometime after 250 AD. Now, that's not my private opinion. That's the argument from this book here. If you want, you can have a look at it later on. The Nag Hammadi Library, which is the standard critical edition of the Gnostic texts. These are people who are very pro-Gnosticism, editing this book and commenting on the texts. And that's the dating which they give to it. Let me just ask you, to which text would you give more credibility? A text written within about 40 years of Jesus' life, or a text written within about 210 years? I take it the Gospels have priority over this much later writing. Secondly, we also need to note exactly what it is that the Gospel of Philip actually says when you look at the text as it's quoted in the critical editions, rather than in the way that Dan Brown quotes it. And I have to say, I think he's been rather naughty here. If you look at the bottom on the screen, that is what the text actually says. So let me read it to you as it really is. The words in brackets are guesses, so you have to omit them to find out what we know the text says. It reads like this. And the companion of the blank, Mary Magdalene, blank her more than blank, the disciples, blank kiss her, blank on her, blank, the rest of blank, they said to him, why do you love her more than all of us? That is very different, isn't it, from the way that he quotes the text in the novel? It's rather less clear what the text is saying. It's rather fragmentary, it's rather uncertain than Brown's quotation and filling in of the gaps suggests. Thirdly, what about this claim about the word companion, that Mary is the companion of Jesus? Well, Brown is simply wrong about the meaning of the word companion. It's not in Aramaic in any case, so why you need an Aramaic scholar to tell you this, I'm not sure. The text is written in the Coptic language, and this word for companion is borrowed from the Greek language. The term is koinonos in Greek. So he's wrong about it being Aramaic, but he's also wrong about what the word koinonos does and doesn't mean. In Greek, it can mean somebody's spouse, but it can also mean a whole host of other things. For example, it might mean someone sharing in someone's activity. A fellow murderer, for example, is the way the word is used in Matthew's Gospel. And it can mean a business partnership, a fellow fisherman, in Luke chapter 5. There are, in other words, plenty of general, non-sexual, non-marital meanings for this word companion. To say that Mary was Jesus' companion need say nothing at all about them being married or having a sexual relationship. But you may say, what about the kiss? Surely the kiss clenches it, doesn't it? Surely the kiss shows that in this context, the word companion is meant to have that sexual overtone. Well, hardly. If you go back in the Gospel of Philip a little bit earlier, we read of how the Gnostics would kiss one another as a standard greeting. Kissing one another in many cultures is a normal thing to do, even for men. And that's exactly what we find described here. Perhaps it was shocking to them that Jesus kissed a woman, but only as a greeting, not more than that. This means that, in short, there is absolutely no ancient evidence for Jesus Christ being married to Mary Magdalene. Claim 7, then. Mary was demonized to discredit her, is our next claim. You remember this? He writes this, the church, in order to defend itself against the Magdalene's power, perpetuated her image as a whore and buried evidence of Christ's marriage to her. So here is the evil church suppressing the true Mary Magdalene, making her out to be a prostitute in order to discredit her testimony. That again doesn't fit the evidence. When the church did come to view Mary Magdalene as a prostitute, which it did, it wasn't until several centuries after the New Testament had been written and settled. When it did it simply because that is an easy way to read Luke's Gospel. Let me explain why. At the end of Luke chapter 7, we read of a prostitute being forgiven. Then at the beginning of Luke chapter 8, we're introduced to Mary Magdalene for the first time. Some people put two and two together and got what may be four or five, and inferred that the prostitute who's introduced at the end of chapter 7 is Mary Magdalene who's introduced at the beginning of chapter 8. Now, the New Testament itself, which according to Dan Brown is part of this great conspiracy against Mary, actually never asserts that Mary Magdalene was a prostitute. People have inferred that from the end of Luke 7 and the beginning of Luke 8. It is an easy inference to make. It may be right, it may be wrong. It wasn't made for hundreds of years until after the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. But let's just imagine for a moment that the New Testament did really depict Mary Magdalene as a prostitute. Let's pretend that it did, which I don't think it does, but let's pretend that it did. Would it really be seeking to discredit her? Let's think about some other figures in the New Testament. Do you remember the Apostle Peter? What kind of a billing does the Apostle Peter get in the New Testament? What does he do? Well, he's most famous, isn't he, for denying Jesus. Three times he says, "I do not know him." Now, is that intended to discredit Peter? Well, that's a bit of a problem for Brown's argument, isn't it? Because Peter, of course, is the one who's anti-Mary. He's the one with a knife in the picture, if you remember. What about Paul? Paul is depicted in the New Testament as a terrible murderer of Christians. He leads a persecution of the early Christians. Is that intended to discredit him and stop Christians taking him seriously? No, it's not. Why not in both cases? Well, because Peter and Paul are both restored. They repent, they come back, and they're restored by Jesus Christ. They're therefore positive examples in the New Testament of people who fall and are then restored. Now, Mary the prostitute, were she in the New Testament, which she isn't, but were Mary the prostitute in the New Testament, she would function exactly the same way, as a positive example for Christians of the transforming power of God's grace in somebody's life, of how somebody who is very sinful indeed in a notorious kind of way can be changed. Saying that she's a prostitute, who's clearly forgiven for her prostitution and changed by Jesus, wouldn't write her off. It would make her, like Peter and Paul, a great example of what God can do in somebody's life. She's in fact, therefore, portrayed positively in the pages of the New Testament. What I want to do now for the rest of our time is to look a bit more at how the New Testament actually depicts Mary and what it says about her. And I need to give you a bit of a warning here, because this is the point at which some of you are going to start fidgeting in your seats and feeling a bit uncomfortable. Because I'm not going to be talking so much about the Da Vinci Code here, I'm going to be talking about what the New Testament says. And although many of you may have been raised on the New Testament and heard New Testament readings many times, it is inescapably the case that, to our modern ears, the New Testament makes some pretty uncomfortable, threatening claims. Because it makes exclusive claims about Jesus Christ and his uniqueness and his importance, which necessarily entail that other people's views are wrong. Now, in our day and age, I'm half in danger of being arrested for saying something like this and saying that actually what some people think, what some religions believe, is wrong. But that is the claim that the New Testament inescapably makes. And if I'm to give you a Christian historian's view of Jesus and Mary Magdalene and to counter Dan Brown's view, I must assert what the New Testament asserts. So I want to invite you, please, not to take offence at this, and to be tolerant of my intolerance, rather than becoming intolerant yourselves as you perceive what you may think is my intolerance. It would be ironic if you did that. I take it also that you are serious thinking people, that you're here this evening because you read this book, and maybe it triggered lots of thoughts in your minds that you haven't had for a long time. I wonder, is it true what it says about Jesus? Who was Jesus really? I wonder if he was married. Maybe it's got you thinking about who Jesus really was. And so also, because I presume that you are intelligent thinking people who are here because you want to reason through these things, I take it that you won't therefore be offended if I set out before you, for your consideration, what the New Testament says about Jesus Christ. So let me ask the question, who was the real Mary Magdalene? And what does the real Mary Magdalene teach us? What does she say to us across the centuries? Well, the most important scenes where Mary appears in the authentic Gospels in the New Testament are at the death and the resurrection of Jesus Christ, seen in these two pictures here. Mary Magdalene in the New Testament sees Jesus die. And she sees Jesus rise again from the dead. And what I want to show you this evening is that this makes her, in the New Testament itself, a very significant, important figure. And there's no way that you can say with Dan Brown that the New Testament tries to downplay her importance when she stands there as a witness of the death and resurrection of Jesus. So I want to show you why, according to the Bible, the death and resurrection of Jesus, which Mary sees, are the two central events in human history, the two most important events in human history. Not World War II, not the election of the president or the prime minister, but the death and resurrection of one man, Jesus Christ, 2,000 years ago, stand at the centre of history, according to the New Testament. And Mary was there, and she is therefore extremely important indeed. So why? Why did Jesus die? Why is Mary seeing Jesus die so significant for her? Now, I don't know if you saw Mel Gibson's film, The Passion. As it happens, I didn't see it, but I gather that flashed up on the screen at the beginning of the film were these words from Isaiah 53. Do you see them there? These words explaining what was going to happen to Jesus in the rest of that film. He was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. Now those words take us to the heart of the Christian understanding of Jesus Christ's death on the cross. Let me see if I can explain why. The New Testament makes a pretty uncomfortable claim about us. The New Testament explains that every human being in human history, apart from Jesus Christ, produces evil from within, evil from the heart. Now, I don't know what you think about that claim. Chances are you probably think, yeah, well, that's true about quite a lot of people, isn't it? I can think of quite a few people like that. You may work with them, or you can certainly read about them in the newspapers. We're quite happy with the claim that there are some pretty evil people around, aren't we? Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, Thomas Hamilton, etc., etc. Some people are obviously evil, murderers, thieves, violent people. But the New Testament says, well, no, you can't just point the finger at people over there and say, oh, it's them, they're the ones with the evil hearts. The New Testament says that we all have evil hearts. Now, in some of us, it's not obvious at all, because we have a social veneer which looks pretty decent, and measured by how we interact socially, we're pretty much okay. But that isn't the New Testament's test. When Jesus explains that the human heart produces evil, he isn't talking about how we appear on the outside, about our social veneer. He's talking about our attitude to the God who made us. And he explains, in the parable of the prodigal son, for example, you probably remember it, that we want to flee from our Creator Father God. We're on the run like that son who wants to go away and squander all of his wealth, and we want nothing to do with God in our lives. And that, he says, is why we're evil. Not because we're murderers or thieves or whatever, but because we're on the run from God's rule over our lives. And the New Testament explains, God is a holy God, and he doesn't just overlook that kind of treatment. He doesn't just forget our rebellion against him, but he will call us to account for it. But because of his incredible love and his mercy and his compassion, he doesn't leave us in that state of rebellion against him, but he sends his only son, Jesus Christ, to rescue people from that rebellion. And this is where we come back to the cross. God does not desire that sinners should themselves be punished, that rebels should bear the punishment for their own sins. And so he sends his son to stand in the place of rebels on the cross. He sent Jesus Christ to suffer death, to suffer the punishment for sin in the place of his people, in the place of evil-hearted people like you and like me. As the words from Isaiah show, Jesus bore the punishment of his people in their place. He took their iniquities, and he provides healing for them. He was substituted for his people. He stood in their place, and their sin was transferred to him. Now, perhaps here this evening you believe that already. Well, if you believe that already, you can see why Mary Magdalene, witnessing the crucifixion, gives her such a prominent role in the pages of the New Testament. The crucifixion, according to the New Testament, is the great central event by which God accomplishes his rescue plan to purchase back people from their rebellion. Here is God's only son, sent as the Saviour, accomplishing his great plan of love on the cross. Here is the moment where the sin of millions, of billions of people is taken up by Jesus Christ and carried on his shoulders on the cross as he bears the punishment for it. And nearby, standing watching, is a woman, Mary Magdalene. She stays when all but one of the male disciples deserted, and she sees with her own eyes the outward bloody effects of this great rescue plan being accomplished by the Son of God. And what happens next? The women discover the empty tomb, and then we read, "So the women hurried away from the tomb, afraid yet filled with joy, and ran to tell his disciples. Suddenly Jesus met them. The women came to him, they clasped his feet, and worshipped him." And so it is that Mary runs to the other disciples as the first person in human history to bear witness to the resurrection of the Son of God from the dead. This is not a detail that anyone would have invented. Women in those days had no legal status as witnesses at all. But here are the Gospels plainly describing her as the first witness. We read in John's Gospel a little more of what happened next. Mary Magdalene went to the disciples with the news, "I have seen the Lord." And she told them that he had said these things to her. Now, why do Christians believe that Mary seeing the resurrection is so important? What is it about the resurrection that's so crucial in human history? Well, notice how Mary announces his resurrection from the dead there. "I have seen the Lord." There's that Old Testament title for God again, the Lord. Mary knows that she has seen Jesus risen from the dead, made Lord of the entire universe, the whole creation. She knew that she was using this word that was an appropriate title for God and applying it to Jesus. She had seen him raised and therefore exalted by God and put in charge of the whole world. Mary was the first human being in history to see with her own eyes the exalted Lord of the universe in this way. Now that makes Mary a very important person indeed in the pages of the New Testament. It makes no sense to think that she's been sidelined by the authors of the Gospels when she stands as a witness to the crucifixion, when she stands as a witness to God's appointed rescue for rebellious human beings like you and me. It makes no sense to think that she's been sidelined when she stands in the pages of the New Testament as a witness to the resurrection, the witness to the event in which Jesus Christ is made Lord of the entire universe. So let's ask this question, because it's important to read a book like Dan Brown's book in a personal, engaged kind of way. It's not just a novel, it's a question which gets us thinking about our own lives. Let me ask you, what does Mary Magdalene say to you this evening across the centuries? Not that Jesus Christ was married and had children whose descendants today walk the streets of modern France, let alone that her remains are buried somewhere in the Louvre. Instead, she speaks to us as a witness. She speaks to us as a witness of the death of Jesus on the cross, as the one place where each of us can find perfect forgiveness and cleansing for all that we have done wrong in our lives. And she speaks to us as a witness of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, telling us that he is indeed Lord of all, Lord of you, and Lord of me. She invites us, therefore, to come to the cross as she did, to greet Jesus Christ as her Saviour and Rescuer. And she invites us, as she did, to bow before the risen Jesus as Lord of our own lives. This is the authentic Mary Magdalene described by the real documents of the New Testament. And this is the authentic Jesus to whom she points us. It may well be that you're thinking about these things. And it may well be that you think that you should think about these things, this claim that Jesus Christ is the only Saviour and Lord that Mary makes to us. If that's the case, can I encourage you as a next move following this evening to take a gospel? There'll be some at the doors. We've got copies of Mark's gospel. You can read this in about an hour easily. And I'd encourage you to read through a gospel with adult eyes and ears and an adult mind engaged to consider the claims that Jesus Christ makes in that gospel. If you gave Dan Brown however many hours of your life it was, wouldn't it be worth consulting the original primary text of the Christian faith to see what you make of what you find there? And if you're interested in more about the heart of the Christian message that Mary points us to, there are some of these booklets called Why Jesus, which describe some of the basics of the Christian message, and you'd be welcome to take either of these things for free afterwards. And we're going to have some time for questions. John's going to talk to you about how that's going to work. We'll have a bit of time to do that, then I'll pop back up and see if I can answer any questions that this has provoked in your minds. Thank you for listening.
Let's say thank you to Gary. obviously very appreciative of the huge amount of work he's put into that. And also perhaps a little challenged about it. We've had to have our thinking caps on tonight, haven't we? Well, it's only right then that we do have the chance to ask questions, questions of clarification, questions of further thought. We're going to give you 5 minutes just to think of your questions. And I'd like to encourage you just to pick up one of these blank white pieces of paper that are under the seats. There should be a pencil there too. And write your question down there. In a couple of minutes, we'll collect them up and bring them up to the front, and we'll try and answer at least some of those before we finish at 9:30. So pick up your white piece of paper, write down your question, and in a few minutes, the size people will pick them up and bring them here to the front.
Have a little look at what we've got. We've got quite a few. You can keep them coming if you want to. People can always pass them up. Some of them I won't be able to read, some of them I won't know the answers to, and some of them I may think are irrelevant or slightly too wacky for us to consider, in which case I'll pass them to the bottom of the pile. But there are lots of really good ones as well. Did Jesus really marry Mary Magdalene or not? Clearly I think I've tried to argue that he didn't. Related to that, though, is another question that a number of people have asked, which is, would it diminish the Christian message if it were proved that Jesus had married? Now, this is a very interesting question. In fact, I asked my colleagues about it this morning over coffee to get their opinion before I sort of went public on what I thought. Given that what Jesus Christ came to do was to die on the cross in the place of sinners and to rise again as their Lord, I see no particular reason why his being married would have prevented him doing that. So I can't see that him being married would have undermined any of the sort of central Christian claims. I think the point would be it would have been an odd thing for him to do because it would have been a distraction from his purpose and his single-minded purpose to come and to die. And you may even think it would have been a slightly cruel thing for him to do given that he knew that he had come to die if he had married shortly beforehand. But I don't think if he were married it would pose a fundamental problem. It's the rest of the stuff that goes with it in Dan Brown's book that poses a problem, where he's married and has children and there's this great secret conspiracy, etc. So it's more that's the problem. There you go, exactly the same question. Is it relevant to our Christian faith if he was married? when is your book coming out? it's not. I would slightly think about turning it into a booklet. The reason for not publishing a book on this is that there are so many already. You may think, well, that's a good reason, jump on the bandwagon. But if you log on to amazon.co.uk or .com, stick in Da Vinci Code, it will bring up a list of, I haven't done it recently, but it's probably 20, 30, 40 books written about the Da Vinci Code. And so there are loads of them. There's even a rough guide to the Da Vinci Code. There are a number of them written from a Christian perspective. I've read a number of them to prepare this talk. One in particular, if you want to pursue the arguments about Jesus and Mary further, I think we've got some copies of this at the back, called Breaking the Da Vinci Code by Daryl Bock. Daryl Bock is a professor of New Testament studies in America. It's a pretty good book that looks at the claims about Jesus, and well worth reading should you want to pursue that further. I therefore don't see any point in writing something that long, though I do sometimes think it might be worth having something sort of pamphlet length to deal with it, because this is a bit long for lots of people to read if they're not particularly into the question. Next question, are you going to write a book to counter the Da Vinci Code? Dan Brown describes the paintings of Leonardo da Vinci. Is there any truth that Mary is painted in the Last Supper painting and Peter cutting or slicing at Mary's throat? Interesting stuff, all of this Leonardo material in the novel, isn't it? Of course, we shouldn't really call him Da Vinci. I live near Southgate at the moment, and calling him Da Vinci is a bit like calling me Southgate. Leonardo da Vinci describes the place where he's from. You should call him Leonardo. Now, if that suggests that I know anything about art history, let me disabuse you of that impression and tell you that I don't, and say straight up, I'm not an expert on Leonardo's paintings. I have been reading a bit about Leonardo's paintings and what people make of Dan Brown's claims, and the overwhelming opinion of the experts on Leonardo is that it's absolute nonsense, all of this stuff that's read into the paintings. I'll give you a couple of examples. The idea that the figure to the right of Jesus, to the left as we look at the painting, is a woman, and rather than John, the beloved disciple, is ridiculed by most art historians because Leonardo normally painted effeminate men. If you look up his painting of John the Baptist and have a look at his painting of John the Baptist, John the Baptist looks really like a woman. And so it was his standard way of portraying men. There's some reason to think that Leonardo was homosexual. Perhaps he liked the look of effeminate men, and that's why he painted them looking like that. There's some possibility that that's the case. So I think there's no reason to think that it's a woman, unless you think that most of the men in lots of other paintings by Leonardo are women as well. The other little detail that I think is highly questionable is Brown's inference from the fact that there isn't one cup in the painting, there are lots of little cups. Do you remember that? Well, he infers from this that Leonardo is trying to tell us that the Holy Grail is not a cup, it is a woman. It is Mary, the vessel that carries the blood of Jesus. Not the literal shed blood, but the bloodline of Jesus in her womb. And he's signalling this by having lots of little cups to tell us there is no cup grail. The problem with that claim is that if you look at paintings of the Last Supper between 1300 and 1500, painted between 1300 and 1500, you'll find that about a third of them do not depict a single cup. Because the chances are, there wasn't a single cup at the Last Supper. Somebody, when I last did this talk, asked me, so what do you make of the Holy Grail? What is the place of the Holy Grail in the Christian faith? And I had to say, I don't think there was a Holy Grail to start with. I don't think there was a single cup. And secondly, if there were, it would have absolutely no significance at all. So chances are that we infer nothing from the fact that there isn't a single cup, because there wasn't a single cup in loads of paintings of the Last Supper. Do you think Dan Brown actually believes what he's written, or is he knowingly seeking to blind people to the truth? I don't think he's knowingly seeking to blind people to the truth. He says on his website, he's got quite a nice website, he says on it that he sort of answers questions. One of the questions is, are you a Christian? He says, yes. And then he sort of goes on, and by the end of it, it becomes that he doesn't quite mean by Christian what the Bible would mean by being a Christian. I don't think it's consciously malicious. I think it may have a negative effect, though bizarrely, I think, probably has the opposite effect of what he's intended, if he did intend it to damage the Christian faith. In fact, it's probably, more than anything else recently, put the Christian faith back on people's agendas. I take it that's why some of you are here tonight, because it's got you thinking again about these important issues, and perhaps, therefore, it's actually served more for the benefit and upbuilding of the Christian faith and its strengthening than for its detriment. But I suspect he was trying to write a rip-roaring novel which would cause a bit of controversy and sell lots of copies, rather than that he was trying to destroy Christianity. Did the Priory of Zion exist? Really interesting answer. So what is the Priory of Zion? I've argued that the texts which suggest it dated back to 1099 are forgeries. They're texts found in the National Library in Paris that were deposited there in the 1950s or 60s and which have been exposed as forgeries by a group of people. However, the Priory of Zion did exist. It was founded in 1956 by, among other people, a man named Pierre Plantard. Now, Pierre Plantard was a rather... he was a fascist, he was an anti-Semite, he hated the Jews, he was a French nationalist, he was convicted of a number of crimes, and he was one of the key people in the Priory of Zion. And he has since said, look, it's got nothing to do with the things that some people have tried to say it had something to do with. If you want to find out more about the Priory of Zion, log on to www.priory-of-zion.com, remembering that Zion is with an S, not a Z. And you will find a website which contains an enormous amount of really interesting documentation exposing all of the myths and nonsense there is about the Priory of Zion. Could Jesus have had a relationship with Mary and not been married but produced a family? Clearly, from the point of view of the New Testament, no, he couldn't, because that would have been immoral. Again, this is one of the uncomfortable claims that the Bible makes in our day and age, which is that sex is to be within marriage only, and therefore extramarital sex is something that needs to be, among other things, that people need to repent of. And so if Jesus had had an extramarital relationship, it would have made him a sinner, which would have meant he couldn't then have died in the place of sinners to rescue them from the things they'd done wrong, because he'd have been in enough trouble for the things he'd done wrong himself. So that wouldn't work. More to the point, there's just no evidence that he had a relationship with Mary. This is what's really interesting about the way that people try to prove things when they start speculating wildly about Jesus. I often find when talking to people about the New Testament that they apply really stringent tests to the New Testament. How can we know it's true? How do we know this? How do we know that? How do we know that? And then suddenly they start speculating about the alternative, and they say, well, maybe Jesus had an extramarital relationship with Mary Magdalene. To which the obvious answer was, how do you know that? How do you know that? What's the evidence for that? And the answer is, there is zero evidence for that claim anywhere in ancient documents. So you can't argue that he did. If you're worried about evidence we need to apply consistent criteria so that if we're going to ask demanding questions of the New Testament, we need to ask demanding questions of our own historical fantasies as well. And we can't just say, it is possible that Jesus had a relationship with Mary, therefore he did. That's the way that a lot of Dan Brown's arguments work. It's a possibility, oh, therefore we can know that he did. But that just doesn't work as an argument, because saying it's a possibility isn't the same as saying that there's any evidence for it at all anywhere. Let's look at the next one. Is there any truth in Dan Brown's comments on the real meaning of the composition of the Last Supper or the Mona Lisa? One of the interesting things about what he says about the Mona Lisa is that actually doesn't say much about it, does he really? There's that writing on it, it's on the cover of the book, but it doesn't really do much. The big thing is the Last Supper and it's like the Madonna of the Rocks, and I've already said a bit about what he says about the painting The Last Supper and whether there's any merit in it or not. Is it not true that Islam thinks that Jesus was human, a prophet, and not divine? It is true, indeed. But the point that you need to remember is that Islam comes along 600 or so years later, after Jesus was alive. So the fact that Muhammad or the Quran may say things about Jesus, really in terms of historical argument, has zero credibility, because it's hundreds and hundreds of years after the New Testament was written, after Jesus lived and died. Now, again, I'm aware that's a pretty uncomfortable thing to say, isn't it, in this day and age, because we all have to be very sensitive about relations between the different religions. But we can't hide from the fact that Islam and Christianity starkly contradict one another in their claims about who Jesus Christ was, whether he was God, whether he was merely a man, whether he died on the cross, whether he rose again. And I would want to point out simply that Islam postdates Christianity by hundreds of years, and Christianity has the texts that go right back to Jesus himself, not Islam. Why has this book caused such a stir? Probably a variety of reasons for that, aren't there? You may be able to think of more than I can. It's been well marketed. I think probably the key is appreciating the religious scene in America, though. That in this country, if somebody publishes a book which attempts to tell a different story of Jesus Christ, probably hardly anyone would bat an eyelid, because whether we know it or not, and despite what many of us think, we live in a non-Christian country now. You may well think I'm a Christian, but in terms of how diligently people attend church, how diligently they hear the Bible being preached, how often they pray, what they believe about Jesus, whether they have a personal trust in Jesus as Lord and as Saviour, measured by those kinds of tests, this is not a Christian country anymore. Church attendance is around about, is under 10% now. It's a myth to call us a Christian country. So you can get away with a lot in this country. But go to America, where 40-something percent of people attend church on a Sunday, and it's quite different. And there, if in that kind of context you start saying Jesus was married and had children, it's going to be hugely controversial. And there are Christians in the media, and the Christian scene in America is just much bigger and more powerful and influential than it is in this country. And therefore it can trigger a controversy there, which it would never trigger over here. And I think probably what's happened is that controversy has blown up in America and has spilt over into other countries. So if you were to look at the books on the Amazon website, you'd find probably, I'm guessing, I've not seen an English one, I've only seen American ones. My guess is they're all American, and I think it's probably because of that context that it's so much more controversial there. You started off by saying that the Gnostic writing did not refer to Christianity, but then went on to discuss Gnostic references to Jesus. Have I misunderstood? Okay, let me clarify. Back near the beginning of my talk, I said that the Dead Sea Scrolls, which Dan Brown calls Christian texts, don't mention Jesus and aren't Christian texts. Okay, and that's clearly the case. The Dead Sea Scrolls do not contain any reference to Jesus Christ or Christianity. But they're not Gnostic texts either. They're Jewish texts from a Jewish sect. The Gnostic texts are the texts from the Nag Hammadi Library, which are collected in this book that I've got here, and those texts do mention Jesus, so I wasn't trying to say that they don't mention Jesus, they do. The key feature with those texts is that they're all much later and way after the time of the New Testament. I hope that clarifies what I was and wasn't trying to say there. We've got a few more minutes for a few more. When were the first Gospels written? Or when were the Gospels first written? That's a really interesting question, which is hard to answer precisely. I've argued briefly that I think they're written before AD 70 because of this massive event in the history of Israel, the destruction of the city of Jerusalem, which they don't discuss. And surely if they're written after that, they would have discussed it, especially as Jesus prophesied it in the Gospels. Surely they would have said, and look, we know it's happened, but they don't say anything like that. and they don't mention it. We've also got fragments of manuscripts of the Gospels which date early in the first century, get back pretty close to arguably to the 50s, 60s. People dispute that slightly. The sort of straightforward answer is we can't pin it down precisely. You have to approach it from a slightly different angle and ask, well, given what we know about the first century and the Jewish religion in the first century and rabbis in the first century, people, the relationship between disciples and their leader, their teacher, their rabbi, what can we therefore infer is reasonable to conclude about how the Gospels were produced? And we know that when people gathered around someone and they called him rabbi, he would teach them in a deliberately memorable form. So Jesus said, the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. It's a memorable, catchy phrase, isn't it? Didn't come to be served, but to serve. And there's a lot of the teaching of Jesus that is like that, typically rabbinic teaching, memorable. And the rabbis were concerned to pass on the deposit of their teaching to their followers, so they made it memorable like that. In fact, there's even evidence that the disciples of rabbis, during the rabbi's life, would sit taking notes as the rabbi taught. Now, when you look at the Gospels and you find Jesus described as their rabbi, their teacher, and you find this and you find them following him around for 3 years, it makes perfect sense therefore to think that the disciples were carefully recording and memorizing Jesus Christ's teaching. And then when in the second century you find leading figures in the early church saying things like Mark's Gospel, the one that you can take away with you tonight, is based on the recollections of the Apostle Peter, which Peter told to Mark, the evidence begins to make sense, you get a complete picture. Here is Peter the Apostle memorizing, perhaps writing down the teaching of Jesus. Here he is meeting Mark, Mark writes it up in a Gospel which is then issued. And that's the best account of where the Gospels came from, which would date them right back into the mid-60s. And which would also show that they rely on carefully memorized material. It's important to remember that Jewish culture in the first century is nothing like our own. I don't know what your memory's like, but mine's a sieve. If I sort of read something or hear something, I forget it very quickly. In those days, they didn't have computers, they didn't have recall, they didn't have encyclopedias like we do, and they had to find ways of remembering things and learn how to remember things. And your memory is, you know, is like a muscle, isn't it? The more you use it, the stronger it gets. And so their culture is much more like, in fact now, an Islamic culture in some parts of the world, where people memorize the entire Quran from cover to cover. That's much more like the Jewish culture of the first century, which suggests again that the Gospels would have been based on carefully memorized material. How can we be sure of the accuracy of translations of ancient scripts? Good question. The answer is there's an enormous industry going into making sure that we get it right. There's a phenomenal wealth of scholarship intended to make sure that we can translate the Greek of the New Testament and the Hebrew of the Old Testament accurately. There are dictionaries, there are commentaries on every book of the Bible. People pore over these texts. And it's, I mean, if I asked you, you know, can we successfully communicate with the French, for example? I must restrain my sense of humour at this point. But probably you'd say yes. You know, every so often there'll be a bit of an understanding. But if we work at it, we'll get clear on what the French person is trying to say if we learn their language and their grammar and their vocabulary. And it's no different with these ancient languages. We've got a huge amount of texts in Greek and a load of texts in Hebrew, and we can work out how the languages worked and we can piece them together. Now, sure, there are some nooks and crannies in the Bible where it's pretty hard to tell what's going on. But on all of the central claims about Jesus Christ, his death on the cross, his resurrection, all of the fundamental elements of the Christian message, it's quite clear that we can translate clearly what is being said and get an accurate sense of it. Probably time for one more. Some of these are similar to ones we've already had. That one's similar. Can you reiterate the dates of earlier documents for the Gospels and the New Testament? I've already talked about the origins of the Gospels a bit. You also want the date for the Council of Nicaea. That's 325. And Constantine's rule, which is 312-ish on, depending on which bit of the empire you're talking about him ruling. Do you recommend that Christians should read it? I think I would. I wouldn't recommend it. I think it's a great read. I don't think it's a great piece of literature. It's a great read. I think Christians should read it because Christians shouldn't have their head in the sand. The Christian faith has absolutely nothing to hide. That's one of the great suggestions, isn't it, of the book, is that it's got something to hide, in particular that the Roman Catholic Church has got something to hide. The Christian faith based on the Bible, has nothing to hide. It's a public religion open to public vigorous scrutiny. And therefore Christians have nothing to fear from a book like this. And I think they should read it, mainly because it's such a topic of discussion and so many people are interested about it. I go to get my hair cut or something and somebody says to me, they find out what job I do, and they say, well, have you read the Da Vinci Code? And we're off on a great conversation about Jesus Christ and who he was. And so I think Christians certainly should read it, because it's got nothing to threaten them, and because many of their friends will be reading it and asking interesting questions about it. Last one. If the Isaiah quotation, he was pierced for our transgressions, he was crushed for our iniquities, refers to Jesus, why is it written in the past tense? Really interesting question. And I think the key answer there is that a lot of the prophecies of the Old Testament are written in the past tense. There's something called the prophetic perfect tense in some languages, which is where a prophet puts something in the past tense to show that it is that certain that it's happened. It's future, but we can put it in the past because it's so certain. And I think that's probably why it's in the past tense there. The Hebrew tense system is a pretty unusual one anyway. I'm going to stop there and hand back to John. If you've still got a question that I didn't answer, because there are quite a few in the pile, do feel free to come and call me afterwards. And if you want to come back on something I've said, and we can talk further about it.
My only question really is how Gary's hairdresser felt after 1.5 hours of conversation. Can I just draw your attention to a few things before you go? Firstly, to say again that there are some free copies of Mark's account of Jesus' life. Gary's just been talking about it. If you haven't read it and you haven't got a copy at home, do please take this with you and read through it. It'll just take an hour or so, hour and a half. Go to the earliest texts and see what you make of this man Jesus. Secondly, do take one of these too. It's free and it gives you a little insight into the Christian message, what its basic message is. Thirdly, there are also some DVDs and videos at the back that just, they're about 15 minutes long, and they present some personal stories from Christians about how they've come to faith in Christ and what that means for them. I think the only other thing to say, again, is that there are books at the back. There's two of these and two of another book, Engaging with the Da Vinci Code from a Christian Perspective. You'd have to buy them off us. They're not free, I'm afraid. But if you would like to buy one, please do see me afterwards. Can I now ask you just to pick up this card? It's underneath your seat. The one that says what's next on it. There's about one between two. So as long as you can see one, that should be fine. The obvious question is, what's next? I hope this evening's been stimulated. My hunch is that it's been very stimulating. My hunch is that you need to go away and think a bit more and to read through one of those Mark's Gospels. Well, there is another couple of things that you can do. Firstly, if you're able, can I encourage you to come back tomorrow night? Tomorrow night we've got a multimedia presentation with a talk and drama and music, all trying to help us think a little more about this message we've heard a little of tonight about Christ. Secondly, can I ask you just to fill this in? Perhaps if you've got a pencil there, you might do that now. There are four options on here that might be a help to you. Firstly, you might say, well, I'm already a Christian, but having heard what I've heard tonight, I feel I would like to go over the basics again. Well, if that's you, do please tick that box. Secondly, you might say, I believe for the first time this week, maybe at this event or at another one. Perhaps you've been thinking about these things for a while and you've come to a point of faith, but you still need to learn more. Well, then please do tick box two. Thirdly, you might say, well, I'm just curious, but I do want to keep considering these things. Well, please then tick box three. Finally, you might say, well, I don't want to take things further at the moment, in which case, tick box four. When you've done that, just turn it over, fill in your details there, and if you hand that in to one of the sides people on the way out, we'll put it in with all the other ones we've received so far, and someone will get in touch with you about some of the ways in which you can continue thinking in the coming months. All the churches in Linfield are putting on courses whereby week by week you might gather together with other people with questions and just start to think these things through for yourself, and we'll send you information about that. Well, it's been a stimulating night. I think we need to say a final thank you to Gary for all his hard work in presenting that to us. And I know that Gary's hope in putting that work in is that this will be something that stimulates you to think further about this man, Jesus Christ. So thank you very much for coming. We do hope to see you again.